You're listening to Around Comics.
Are listening to Around Comics episode 451. Welcome back. It's Thursday, which means we're live on YouTube and Facebook and all those places. And we have a very special episode in store for you folks. We're doing something new. We're trying something new here on Around Comics after all these years. We have a new segment. This is the brainchild of Mr. Christopher Neesman.
Format change.
Format change, as we've been known to do in the past. This is going to be Around Comics Under the Influence. What is Under the Influence? Well, basically, we have special guests on, and they're going to talk about one single issue of a comic book that has influenced them in some way in their work or their life or whatever it may be. And this week, we are joined by a very special guest, a friend of the program, an alumni, an Around Comics alumni, Mr. Will Pfeiffer. How are you, Will?
I'm honored to be here. I very much am.
Well, you are in the larger Around Comics family as one of our co-hosts for Film Wars 5.
Yeah, but here, this is
what we refer to as the AC fam.
That's right, the AC fam.
What we call it.
as we call it, the fam. So the book that you have chosen as the one single issue, because we kind of put a hard limit on it, it had to be one single issue. You picked Daredevil issue 181. It is a special double size.
It's double size. I think this is a rule that we'll have to no double size.
I appreciate Will kicking this off by going with Citizen Kane, just so we can get it out of the way.
Right? Now, when you do Centaurs number one, Chris, we won't be as like,
Centaurs. You know, when Will's on Film Force 5, like getting him to pick a mainstream movie, like a, you know, it's like, it's always something from the 1920s. It's some foreign film, something, you know, a British film or something. And it's like, for comics, Daredevil 181. I'm just going to pick one of the most like classic and renowned comic books.
But this
of
comic
all time,
is so over what, 40 years old now. This is a,
This is
the issue. I bought this at my local corner store before I even started going to comic book stores. This was just off the rack at the corner store. It was a $1 cover price for a double issue back then.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is kind of crazy. I've been a Daredevil fan pre-Frank Miller. I was buying just before he started, you know, doing Daredevil is when I started buying Daredevil. And I also bought it. I didn't go and dig mine out because I don't know where it is. It's somewhere in a box somewhere, but I did dig out the omnibus that has it on the cover of the my green screen's kind of screwing it up, but there you go, the Daredevil 181.
I don't know how we
haven't done this before, so I guess, you know, we got to kind of figure out what this is going to be, but I guess let's start with
I have been buying. This is a couple years after I really got into comics, and I started buying, like, you know, Batman and DC Comics Presents and Brave and the Bold, and then I switched over to Marvel when I discovered the Byrne Claremont X-Men. So I was really into that, and somehow I stumbled onto almost the first issue of Miller's Daredevil. It was just like, I don't know what cover or. I mean, because I didn't hear about it anywhere back then. I didn't have any fanzines and there was no internet, obviously. So I just stumbled onto it and I loved it. And, you know, I was really into, you know, it was all ninjas and Elektra back then. And so when I saw this issue and you read on the cover, it says Bullseye versus Elektra, one wins, one dies. And even then, in the early days, I had seen that dodge a million times. So I never actually figured anyone would die in this issue. But spoiler alert, Elektra does in fact die in this issue. Now, she's been brought back multiple times, but, you know, as far as this one was concerned, for a while she was actually dead. And so that part, that sort of made it memorable.
That was at a time in comics where, I mean, deaths had a more of a prominence right. to them. I mean, there weren't a lot of characters that had, you know, come back. You know, this is, yeah, it's also like the era of, you know, death of right. Captain Marvel, and where it's like, yeah, he was
Phoenix,
never going
to
come
this had
back,
to be right? the era of Phoenix dying. So it might have yeah. been just a little before this, maybe. I can't quite remember when, but yeah, it was that era. And those deaths were, they felt permanent, even if they weren't permanent, but they sure felt that way. And so that was one reason it was memorable. But plus, it's, you know, just like, Sal, you just showed the splash page where it, I mean, how that, you know, and this has a Comics Code seal on it, by the way. This is a violent comic.
A lot of people die.
And, you know, this is the era you can see the blood is black. Like, that's how they dodged code, yeah. I guess. All the blood was black. But there is a lot of
shadows. It's in the shadow. Yeah.
Well, it works mm-hmm. with Miller's art. For
it
sure,
works perfectly.
Right?
And the other thing is, I mean, this is just Miller and Janssen at, you know, just peak synergy. I mean, not only Klaus Janssen's inks on this, but probably more importantly, in a way, his colors are incredible in this issue. And, you know, I'm looking at the old smelly newsprint issue, so I'm not sure if it works as well on glossy paper, but boy, it just looks great. It's like a limited color palette. And, yeah. you know, there's actually some duotone shade he uses in various places here and there, or some zip tone. And it really, you know, it's so the art, story, but also this is one Miller, you know, this is obviously pre Dark Knight, pre Born Again, pre Year One, all pre Ronin even. And he was really, you know, it's so unlike other Marvel or especially DC comics of the day. Really thin panels, either vertical or horizontal. I mean, he breaks up the page in really interesting ways. You know, he packs a lot of panels on some pages. So it's, you know, it really controls that rhythm. It's really tight. But then he has a page where Bullseye is lying around drinking, and he stumbles onto what he thinks is Daredevil's secret identity. And it's just a giant, like, you know, big panel of Bullseye with white space.
I call it the ha-ha-ha page,
right. And it's so yeah. graphically, you know, it's beautifully done. And, you know, I mean, Miller nowadays, I mean, he's been around, you know, it's like almost 50 years in the business, I guess. And, you know, his stuff now is, you know, it's whatever it is. And he's done some good stuff, and he's done some, you know, his style has certainly loosened up over the years. But boy, he could really draw back then. And he really knew how to use word balloons sparingly. I mean, the page where Elektra actually gets killed, there's no dialogue at all. There's one piece of dialogue on the next page where she says Matt. But I mean, it reads so differently from your average comic of the time. And even, you know, it's continuing what he did in earlier issues, but it just, even now when I haven't read it in probably 10 years. And when I just reread it today, it holds up. I mean, some parts don't hold up perfectly, but boy, it pulls you right through. And it just works as it works so well as a story, with its peaks and its valleys, and it's all building to a big moment. And then after the big moment, we have sort of the denouement where, you know, the follow up, and it's good. It's good stuff. It's also dedicated to Wally Wood, by the way, I noticed. Because I think he must have died just before this was completed or something.
Yeah, I think he passed away right at that. Mm-hmm. I think they like announced it in the letters page.
Yeah, it says we dedicate this that to Wally Wood, who, of course, drew very early issues of Daredevil with us, Stan. Mm-hmm. And I inked one of Miller's covers, I want to say, on Daredevil. Like the one with Matt holding his dead dad in the boxing ring. I want to say Wally Wood inked that. One of his last things.
Oh, okay. There's the Frank Castle.
Yes, that's cameo. Right. And that's well used. This is before he became the icon of police officers everywhere, you know. But and this is this before or after? Maybe it's maybe written after, but published before. But they had those two issues of Daredevil with PCP that originally they didn't publish because of the code, and then I think they published them. They slotted them in later, but it was Daredevil versus the Punisher or something. And it's Miller's first run on Daredevil was an interesting time in comics,
right? Yeah, there's the Daredevil Punisher, the two part story is issues 180.
Okay, so almost right after this, then.
Yeah,
and that was like very controversial. I remember they had to. I think they had to hold it because it showed drug use.
Oh, that's well, it's got the great cover. It's the Daredevil kind of Dirty Harry cover. Mm. Yeah.
Those covers.
Yeah, I mean, it held. I haven't read it in a long time. It held up. The one part that did make me laugh is when Bullseye's like, she's chained as a ninja. And it's supposed to be like a real like mic drop moment of like, oh. Oh, wait, no way, bro. She trained as a ninja? Oh, no. I don't know why. I don't know why that struck me as funny. Like, just like very 80s. Like, oh, very ninja. 80s. Like, that's all you need to say. Is like,
hey, man, that's it.
So many ninjas.
Are they more specific? Just ninja.
Basic ninja.
Basic ninja. What more do you need?
One panel that struck me in this, I'm looking at, it's when Bullseye narrates the whole issue, and so he's narrating it as we see Matt Murdock at home getting news that he's escaped on the radio. And he's walking past the wall with tons of photographs and pictures on the wall, and I'm wondering, why does Matt Murdock have all those pictures on the wall? I guess it's
for guests. It's for guests, Will. I mean, you know.
But this does...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've read this in a long time. Like I didn't read it when it came out at the time. It was only years later because I am not a big Daredevil fan. Like I'll read Daredevil sometimes, but it's certainly not something like I usually pick up. It has to be for whatever reason. I'm like, oh, I hear that this is good. I'll go get it. And even then I might like slide out of there. But yeah, I mean, just like in reading this after having not read it in a long time, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Like these are really this is really good, you know. And it's like the use of narration. It's like he like kind of switches what kind of book it is at times, where it's like, oh, this is a superhero book, and then it's suddenly like, oh, actually, this is just like a martial arts story, and then it's like a revenge story, and it's like sometimes it's all thought. It's all, you know, caption, and sometimes it's all dialogue, and sometimes there's neither, and like just like switching it up throughout the book. So it's kind of like, I don't really know what's going to happen next, you know? And it's like, it's surprising.
It is. And it's, I couldn't remember. I mean, I remember the, you know, the big events of the story, but some of the stuff, and it surprised me, I'd completely forgotten that Bullseye sort of stumbles onto Daredevil's secret identity. He later is tricked into thinking he was wrong, but then he presents it to Kingpin, and Kingpin is like, oh, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But of course, later, Miller would come back to Daredevil and use that for just a, you know, I think Born Again is Born one Again. Of the great, you know, Marvel superhero stories, and, you know, he really made the most of it, but
here it's, oh, for sure.
The way,
yeah, I love, I mean, I think one of my favorite, like, I was going to say, it's one of my favorite scenes where Bullseye throws the scalpel and Matt it stops it with his cane, and that's the big tip off. It was like, what a great way for, you know, for this maniac. It's like, well, yeah, if it's not Daredevil, I'm going to kill this very prominent New York City lawyer. You know, if it is, then I'll know because I'm a psychopath.
I mean, I think there's something very Frank Miller about, like, Daredevil's identity gets figured out because, like, of course someone would figure it out. You, like, you're a lawyer. You're not, like, a mechanic.
Right, yeah, he's a, like, in a of course profile lawyer who's in the papers all the time,
It's like, of course, it's not even like Bullseye is some sort of mad genius. He's just like, oh, that guy kind of looks like Daredevil. You know, like, he just kind of, like, pieces it together because, yeah, of course, you know, like the fact that Matt Murdock's like mix of like doubt and sort of hubris of like, oh yes, like I can do all of these things. And then it's like, of course someone's going to figure it out. Like you're not magic. You're not like Superman with like duplicate robots to help cover. It's like, yeah, someone figured it out. You get up in front of people and you talk all the time.
Yeah, his voice.
And you're all over the place.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at the cover, and I don't know if I've ever noticed before, Daredevil has no eye holes in his costume. So,
Hilarious.
Wait a minute.
His ears are covered up and things on the costume. But I also like the whole. It starts, the reason Bullseye is able to escape from prison is because he is interviewed on the Tom Snyde show. Very good.
Yeah.
and he escapes them. But it's, you know, I don't think I realized at the time, but I've since learned, I think Tom Snyder had Manson on his show once, and this had to be what Miller's referencing. So,
yeah, it's a little bit of a precursor to how Miller uses his, you know, his views on media and like DKR. We see a lot of those breadcrumbs that go back into Daredevil.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Do you spend all of your waking moments watching reality TV? Well, you're in good company. I'm Will.
And I'm Marissa. And we're the hosts of Cheers to Chaos Reality TV and Cocktails, a new weekly podcast that covers the ever so entertaining and cringy world of reality television.
Each week, we'll be raising our glasses and diving into the latest drama and chaos from our favorite reality TV shows.
From 90 Day Fiancé to The Bachelor, you've got all your reality favorites covered.
So grab a drink and join us as we clink our glasses to the hilarious and delightful train wrecks of reality TV.
Subscribe now to Cheers to Chaos Reality TV and Cocktails on your favorite podcast platform.
It was interesting. I was thinking about that scene. And then I was thinking about the Quentin Tarantino script for this Natural Born Killers, and the scene where how Woody Harrelson's character gets out of jail because he's being interviewed by Robert Downey Jr. Yeah, Wayne Gale, and then he uses that to break out. And it's like, gee, I wonder if because that was a decade later, or more. I wonder if that was sort of influenced by.
I think it's safe to say that Quentin Tarantino has read Daredevil 181.
Sure. I think he has. And you know, the scene where Bullseye does escape, and he does it by, it's established earlier that if he gets these horrible splitting headaches, and the guard will give him a pill and calm him down, and he fakes a headache, he gets the pill, and then he spits the pill into the guard's eye and distracts him. I thought it was like, okay, even if, how's he going to get out? Cause he's got these giant shackles on and all that. It was, it reminded me sort of how Alan Moore, the scenes with Rorschach in prison, and you're like, well, how's he going to get out? And it's like kind of smart and exciting to see how he does it. And I think it's pretty good to see, you know, Bullseye sort of use his powers and use his smarts to get out. Now, he also hijacks a police helicopter that he flies into Manhattan. I still don't know how. Yeah. You land with nobody noticing you, and you think it'd be easy to keep track of a police helicopter, but
goes off like, oh, there he goes. Yeah. Like, he's got the helicopter.
If only we could do something about it.
If only we had another helicopter. We only have one.
All right, he got it.
Well, it was the early 80s.
And you know, I'll be honest, when I was a kid and I read this, I'm sure I didn't think of it, you know. Was so exciting.
Think that, yeah.
No, of course he escapes in a helicopter. That's how supervillains escape prison islands.
Right. He was on Rikers. I mean, that's the thing about I was rereading an old Comics Journal interview that was around the time this probably came out, and he actually has a quote. He says, like, I wish I was writing about Gotham City, because then I could basically, he could do anything, but if he's writing about New York, he feels he has to be some sort of realistic, and he does, you know, he's on Rikers Island, I think, and then into Manhattan, and he uses the cabs and the elevated train, although there aren't that many elevated trains in Manhattan, but you know, it is a very New York book, and this is before I ever went to New York, so I, you know, this is what my vision of New York was like, was this and various cop shows, but
I mean, we've talked on here about how if you're the being like, I'm the guardian of Hell's Kitchen is like a very reasonable amount of territory.
Yeah.
To like,
it's not a block.
Like, I'm just going to be.
Especially for a guy that
it's
doesn't
like
fly.
It's like a building. This is like.
It's like it's a neighborhood. It's, it's a reasonable amount. It's not the whole island.
No, but.
Let's not get crazy.
It's too bad.
It's a good choice.
I guess it's too bad Daredevil could not protect Hell's Kitchen.
That's right. That is the foe not conquer.
That's the one weird thing is that reading comics from, you know, the crime comics from the 70s and 80s, they were in a New York that was really like slumlords and very high crime. And it's just, that might be the thing for, you know, like a Gen Zer to read this and be like, I've been to Manhattan.
Nobody
there's
can
no
afford
place
to live
like
there.
This.
The first time I ever went to Manhattan or New York in general was in 87, and it still had a little bit of this vibe to it. Nowadays, though, that's just fuck.
You know,
cleaned up Times Square.
One of the things about this, reading it again, that that really struck me, you know, a couple of things were just one, as a kid reading it, it was like, oh, wow, this is a continuation of this story. You know, like Frank Miller up until, not that he was the first to ever do it, but like there was a sense of these characters are all interacting with other and affecting each other's lives. And that story just continued to play out with Kingpin and Daredevil and Elektra and Gladiator and all these characters that Matt dealt with. You see them come back later. And this was one of those things where it's like, oh, wow, Bullseye's really affected by his last fight with Daredevil. Like, and that was something I felt was really kind of unique in the sense where you didn't really have that. Like, you know, Spider-Man would fight the Vulture again, and it wasn't like a continuation of psychological, you know, torture that he's going through. And that I thought was so brilliant of Miller to, and I think this is, you know, his use of Bullseye really elevated that character to such an iconic villain because, like you said, it's from his point of view. And he uses that so well to really get into the mind of this character and see why he's so driven and so, you know, crazed by Daredevil and just, you know, is just has to try and kill him. And he just, you know, does what he does, kills Elektra and tries to kill Foggy and all these characters. I just thought it was such a unique kind of thing at that time in comics that nobody had really been doing that, where you're seeing this stuff play out. And then, you know, the other part of it is just the way that this story isn't about Matt. You know what I mean? Like, it's really not about Matt Murdock. This is a Bullseye story.
It's all, it's all from his point of view. I mean, he's in it more than Daredevil a lot. And even when what's interesting is, you know, he thinks Daredevil is Matt Murdock, and then he thinks he was wrong. So as he's narrating it at the end, he's saying, you know, well, I might not have gotten you, Daredevil, but your friend Matt Murdock, hopefully this hurt him or something. And of course, then you see Matt. It's not the most spectacular writing ever, but especially for back then, and even now, it's just smart writing. Like, have the narration be about the characters you're looking at, but the narrator doesn't know really what's going on, but it reflects on, you know, it makes it more powerful because he doesn't realize he is talking about Daredevil when he's talking about Matt Murdock. And then you see Matt all sad at the grave and all that. And yeah, it's really good. That issue.
I love how Bullseye in the narration is like constantly making himself out to be the
villain.
All these things that Daredevil is.
You did this to me. You made me do this.
This is your fault. That issue, because they flash back to him when he was on the train tracks and Daredevil saved him. I forget what issue that was. It was not too many before this. That's also a really strong issue, and it's a really Bullseye focused issue. And it's so nice to see it play off, like, not just plot wise, but like psychologically. Like, he hasn't forgotten, and this, he's really pissed about it.
Yeah, and Bullseye has got clarity, as opposed to Matt. You know, like, Bullseye is like, he has no doubt about like what he's doing. He's not like, he's crystal clear on like what he wants to do, and you know, in comparison to Daredevil, who's, you know, character so like angsty at times and like sort of, you know, like what do I do? Am I doing the right, you know, like there's clear, you know, Bullseye is clear. He does not have any doubt, you know, and like that comparison to like not really ever, you know, Daredevil barely, I can't even remember if him in costume ever says a single word.
I don't know.
Other than like,
might not.
Like, yeah, as opposed to like, you know, when he's lawyering it up and talking a lot, but you know, just like that idea that Bullseye has that clarity of purpose that, you know, Daredevil, even though he's the hero, never seems to have the exact clarity of, like, what is it I'm trying to do? Like, am I doing the right thing? You know, he's always wrapped by
that. Well, it's the Catholic guilt.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
Bullseye
does not have
that. Yeah, even at the end, when Bullseye is, you know, laying there literally paralyzed from the neck down or something, he still is. I mean, and the motif that goes through this whole issue, I don't know how many panels have it, but just his eyes staring out, his eyes staring out, his eyes staring out. And that's the last thing you see. And he's, you know, he's saying, I'm going to, I don't care how long it takes. I'm going to get you.
This is just another prison.
And even Elektra, who, you know, she was the cold, icy killer in all this. She has that moment when she's going to kill Foggy. And he says, wait, you were Matt's girl in college. And there's that panel where she like breaks her. You know, and it's a really, it's like a really nicely drawn picture of her face where their eyes wide and she's suddenly she's not the cold killer. And that essentially is where she's doomed. She dies after that. She's like let her guard down and now gone.
But it's that last moment of kindness that we see from her that, you know, in a weird way, if you look at this, and we can have different opinions. I look at this as kind of like the end of Miller's larger Kingpin
story.
Yeah,
I think so.
Right? It's like, and then the next issue is more of an epilogue, right? You know, and I think that that moment where she lets Foggy go is like the redemption of Elektra in a lot of ways.
Well, I think it comes later. I mean, a bit, but
within this story, if this were the end of Miller's like arc, that he's the larger.
Because she dies a few pages.
That's just how I look at it.
There's that, and she her last word is Matt when she's on his doorstep. She goes to his house, and it's. I mean,
it's a great fight scene.
It's brutal too.
It is. Comics 101, this is a fight scene. So good.
I will argue that this line here, put up pretty good fight, Toots. You're pretty good. But me, I'm magic, is one of the most badass fucking lines from a villain. And then he hits her in the throat with an ace of spades.
And then he says, and now for my next trick. And then you get that panel that's like... The legendary, she killed so many people like that. Like for a long time, Daredevil was just panel after panel of people's shirts being pushed out and somehow not ripping. It goes through their chest and bones, but you know, that fabric is strong.
Unstable molecules.
Obviously not that sharp, right?
There could be some, you know, bone and
there is,
meat
but they
on
don't want that. Would not get into Comics Code Authority.
I think it just
it does look
cool.
Cool.
So, do you think maybe would if they showed the bloody sigh, would that have not gotten past the Comics Code?
I don't. Reading this issue, I mean, it must have either the code just didn't care at this point,
Somebody paid somebody off at the old.
Now it wouldn't get by.
Throats are getting slit with cards. Like it's just, it's gruesome. It's like,
and it's, you know, it's a man, you know, two assassins, but it's a man killing a woman, beating her, and then killing her. It's pretty brutal. Plus, the smoking alone wouldn't get it a code pass now.
I wanted to point out something that I noticed. Like you talked about the black blood, but. Cleverly, they use this pink mist every time someone dies. And on the first page with Daredevil getting shot in the head, the whole rest of the page is this pink mist. And that's
panel right there with clever is the pink mist, right?
The pink mist. And that's
Klaus Janson. I think I picked up on that.
That is so cool.
It's a really clever use of a, you know, effect, you know, because that's sort of the. That's that, you know, kind of thing of like, you know, a gunshot is like that pink mist of blood, little tiny droplets of blood. And yeah, so that's obviously a very, you know, thought.
I mean, I'm
trying to see where else,
you know, kind of the way you're looking for that, the brilliance of Miller, you know, you listen to comic book artists and writers, and Will, you actually do this about getting your characters to act on page. His characters just act at this point in his career, you feel like you're watching a movie.
That's the thing. It's like, you know, reading this, this is before I had discovered like Will Eisner, you know, and so it's hard to explain now how different this was from virtually every other comic. I mean, even really good comics like, you know, the X-Men or, you know, Teen Titans, which was a lot of fun. They didn't look like this. Mm-hmm. They weren't this stripped down and, you know, it was they just didn't feel the same way.
Yeah. I love the bullseye, the end of the bullseye fight with Daredevil, that after all the talk of training and all of that, it's like this simple act of balance that he uses to beat him. It's such good a good
bouncing on the wire. Just
that wire bends in a weird way though at one point. I'm not quite sure how that worked. It's like goes and then it but you know, in the end,
but that's just like
In the end, I mean, because it's all contrasting to the last time they fought, Daredevil saved his life, and he hates that. And this time, Daredevil does not save his life. But Daredevil really didn't have a choice, because he's holding him, and Bullseye brings the Psy up. He had to let go. I mean, he couldn't have decided to hold on.
He's also fucking pissed.
But all he does is drop him. I think it's... hit him, he just drops him, you know, and he falls...
I think it's a little ambiguous in the sense of like, well, we don't want Matt to be a cold-blooded killer, so there's kind of an excuse there. Yeah. But
you're not going to kill anyone anymore.
He says it. You'll kill no one ever again.
No sound effects on that page. He just hits, and you know, he hits like right on his neck. It's good.
Yeah,
but I mean, that's a very Daredevil thing to do. To be like, I'm just gonna. And let him break his back.
I'm not gonna kill him.
I'm just gonna and I'm sure I'll feel okay about this later.
He goes to the hospital then, and like one or two issues later, and like holds a gun on him while he does a monologue for the whole issue or something.
Well, that's the issue. Yeah, the famous. I love that cover. Yeah, of that's Daredevil. It. No more Mr. Nice Guy. And
like Terry Austin inked it, how do I know this?
The Dirty Harry cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Dirty Harry. Well, speaking of like movies, so, and we talked about this on Film Force 5, but you know, was it 1980 that Taxi that Driver like came
76.
Out?
That was a few years earlier. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Raging. Oh, you're. I think
but still, that was definitely in the air. You know, I mean, that there were so many new
in the air,
like the Death Wish sequels and all that were out around then, and
yeah, but just the idea of like. Seeing it from Bullseye's perspective, it reminds me of like Taxi Driver monologue. In that sense. Like this the monologue, the driven, you know, sort of psychosis of Bullseye and why, you know, kind of the peek into the mind of a maniac kind of thing, which is similar.
Well, it's in the narration, and we talk about him, you know, building up his victimhood. It's almost like he's pleading with you to think of him as like, the hero.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. This is my story. Even though, you know, I'm the hero here. I'm the one you should be identifying with. And
who do you think he's talking to?
I don't know. It's just,
I don't.
I mean, if you think of it like in a meta way, like who is Bullseye?
I've literally never thought of that.
He's talking. He's talking to Daredevil, right? Like,
he says you've got to suffer first. Yeah. He is talking to Daredevil. Really? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because I actually kind of take it a little, like, the thing that interests me about this reading it now is how, to me, un-Marvel-y Bullseye is as a villain. It's like, he is like, he's it's not like like a Doctor Doom or like a later stage Magneto where you're sort of like, oh, I can see like glimmers of something that is recognizable as like, it's like Bullseye is a homicidal like maniac. Mm-hmm. Like he's coming to kill that he doesn't
know. He's not sympathetic.
Has no like, there is no redemption. There is no larger like goal that somehow you could see him as perhaps being the hero, you know, like he wants to kill Daredevil and he wants to hurt the people around him. And he's very clear about doing that the entire time.
He kills a lot of people in this issue who aren't Elektra. I mean, he kills a bunch of cops and sort of, you know, criminal bystanders.
Cops, criminals. Yeah. He's a psychopath. It doesn't matter. They're just kind of in his way.
They're not a factor to him. Yeah.
But it's interesting just in the context to me of like, this is very like not sort of Marvel-y as far as like what you would say is like a Marvel villain is like this guy, not even like the Kingpin, who the Kingpin you could kind of see is like he's got a humanity. Yeah,
he's got his wife.
To him at times.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's elements of him that you can recognize, whereas like Miller's made Bullseye sort of like unflinchingly like intense, and like he's crystal clear, and like nothing will short of death, and probably not even death will stop him from what he's going to do.
It's great. I mean, it's a great, and he used Bullseye like throughout, you know, he was in that one issue, and I think maybe once or twice before in Miller's run. I mean, he, you know, and I don't, before that, Bullseye was just a guy. I can't remember.
Yeah.
It wasn't much.
I mean, it's also...
You go back and read some of the earlier Daredevil issues with Bullseye, and he is almost arcade-like in his cartoonishness. Mm-hmm. He's really feels like a circus villain. I think even one of the issues is at a circus. Miller did what Miller does. He took that kernel of that idea of that character and was like, no, this is a cold-blooded killer. He's a psychopath, and we're going to portray him like that. He's an
remember
assassin.
When Oscar nominee Colin Farrell played him in the movie, and he was bald and had the Bullseye brand on his forehead or whatever.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
But just like
we've come a long way,
you know, the way that Miller lets like the story sort of unfold with the aspect that Bullseye is, like I said earlier, he's not a genius. Mm-hmm. He's not like some like sort of like super genius who's got some trick, but he's not even particularly like clever. Like he's shrewd.
He's upset.
Yeah.
He's upset.
And he's, you know, he knows what he wants to do, and he just keeps moving forward. You know, he hears that, you know, Foggy Nelson is a target of Elektra. So he slaps that bug on his back, follows him. I mean, it's pretty simple what he does. And, you know,
Bullseye first appeared in Daredevil 131 in March 1976, created by Marv Wolfman and John Romita Sr. He first battles and defeats Daredevil at a circus to establish his reputation as an extortionist.
He wasn't even an assassin.
It wasn't his use anything as a weapon. Like, you know, he uses the pill. There's a scene in some issue where he
playing cards.
Is he killed playing like cards. A fly with a paperclip or something? He like hits him in that?
Yeah.
Probably.
Well, that was the Colin Farrell bit, is that he kills a bunch of people, but you know, he undoes the paperclip and uses it to kill somebody. So they pick that bit up. But yeah, I think that they actually use that in this episode pretty well, that anything can be a weapon to him, you know. And then there's the whole thing of him using, you know, Elektra's own weapons to kill her, and then to
fight. At this point, those weapons were like iconic because she used them all the time. You know, those size. I mean, because it was like you're right. It was ninjas were big. Yeah, you know, we used to go to flea markets and buy throwing stars and stuff like that. And it was the era.
Real throwing stars. They sold them to children.
Yeah. And there's a part where he's in a waterfront bar and like these like fat killers like immediately bust out the nunchucks, and it's like
it was just in the air back in the 80s. You were like a crook.
I owned multiple katana, nunchucks, throwing stars, Psy. I had a pair of Psy.
That's the thing, man.
You got Frank Miller.
It was like real Chinese throwing stars.
We would throw them and hit trees.
Frank Miller.
They were the greatest.
Me and my friends, one Halloween, all walked around with real fucking katanas in full head to toe ninja costumes, slicing up pumpkins all over town, got stopped by the police.
Yeah.
And they just were like, okay, have a good Halloween.
That would not happen now, friend.
Like, we're like 12 years old.
Running with a sword.
Sharp, like, yeah, with sharpened fucking swords in all black ninja costumes.
Oh my,
it was like terrorizing the neighborhood. And
yeah,
it was. It really
yeah,
was.
Frank Miller to think for the whole ninja culture, you know, really becoming.
Well, I mean, obviously, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was so influenced by run of Daredevil.
Yeah,
I mean, and created that a frenzy of ninja movies and
TMNT
everything else.
Is a love letter to Miller's.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, everyone always says Ronin, but it's really Daredevil. You know, I mean,
Daredevil.
Their origin story is the Daredevil's, same right? incident as
the radioactive stuff and all that.
Yeah, hits him and then goes into the
hand car, and the foot. I mean, it's like,
she
it's
was not trained far, as a ninja. Shit.
Well, we talked about earlier in the episode. He's like, and I know what you're doing. You're off practicing your karate.
Yeah.
Listen, this was at a magical time where people still thought like karate and ninjutsu were like real effective.
Well, those are the
combat.
Only two.
Daredevil's off at his fancy gym practicing his karate.
No, you had kung fu as well.
And you had
kung
like
was
this the era of you know, the ninja, you know,
Taekwondo,
Ninja the Domination, and all those movies were. Franco Nero is a ninja.
Cannon had a bunch
Italian
of
actors.
American Ninja.
American Ninja. You had all the Shokasugi Shokasagi? I can't remember.
Talked about that book, I don't know if you got it, Sal, but I was talking about this. There's this incredible coffee table book called Our Fists Break Bricks that's all about like martial arts pop culture from the 60s to essentially like the late 80s. But it has all the ninja stuff and when nunchucks were popular. And it even has like a whole thing on Count Dante and his karate school.
Someone needs to do an independent comic about Count Dante. Like Ed Pisker needs to do a Count Dante comic. Right? Like it seems like right up his alley.
I don't know who could write it. God, I remember there's this kid in my grade school who loved ninja. He was like the one who bought Ninja Stars and like he had like the catalogs with all like the ninja stuff in it. We had to do this thing where we had to do reports on like every country, right? And he picked Japan. And his report was solely about like ninjas and samurai. And there was no other information.
I want to read that report.
Yeah.
I want to be friends with him.
I want to read that.
You know,
so okay, have any of you seen the movie? It's a Chuck Norris movie called The Octagon. So I don't know how long ago it was. 1980 is when it came out. And I think it was a canon movie. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible movie. But I challenge you because I watched it one night and I might have been a little either high or intoxicated on something. And I started to get in my head the thought that the movie is really about a psychopath, Chuck Norris, who's like paranoid delusional and thinks he's being attacked by ninjas all the time, but is really just murdering people all around town. And if you watch that movie with that in mind, it's a totally different film and it's way better.
I want to point out, as long as you're on the topic of karate, is that in this original issue, we had on one page, we had an ad for I'll make you a master of karate for $1.99, and then we have the life size.
Oh, show it. Hold it up.
Dummy.
Hold it up. I got to see this.
See.
Dude.
$1.99. And these, I mean, you guys know, these ads used to be ubiquitous in comic books.
You're reading this comic.
That's what the honest
meant. And you're like, $1.99 for a dummy? Exactly.
To be a ninja?
And I can stab it with my own sai? You know? It's like, hell yeah.
I'm in.
You guys ever order anything out of a comic?
I don't know if I know.
Oh, yeah. I ordered, what are the little horses?
Oh, sea monkeys.
Sea horses?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sea monkeys.
I ordered sea monkeys. I ordered x-ray specs and never got them.
Of course.
There's
I don't think. I ordered a bunch of stuff out of comics for sure.
So, Will, that has that has a comics price guide. I don't know if it's mile high or whoever it was at the time.
Let's see. It's Moon Dance from Vermont.
Okay. What's X-Men number one going for? The mail order X-Men.
Well, let's see. We have giant size X-Men number one. $70 bucks even back then.
Yeah. Oh damn!
That's 1980.
And let's see.
1980.
It doesn't have X-Men number one.
81.
Okay.
Well, that's also right when Phoenix happened. Maybe that's also the peak.
Death of Phoenix is $750.
You know, all this ninja talk, and I just realized I kind of am sporting a Lee Van Cleef look from John Carpenter's Escape from New York. I got a little bit of a little Lee Van Cleef.
In space.
As I get older, I think I'm just going to
cut. You're just going to lean into the Lee.
Yeah, man.
Lean into Lee.
He had a long and satisfying
Yeah, absolutely. Well, okay, we know, this is a book that you picked and we've talked extensively about the issue itself, but I wonder, can you point to anything in your work as a comic book writer that this directly influenced or indirectly influenced, or anything where maybe you pulled something out of this issue or anything like that?
I don't know if I can think of anything specifically as a professional comic book writer, although sort of the idea of, interesting panel layouts and stripping back the dialogue and that sort of thing. And I think, especially when I was first starting out, when I was writing fight scenes, I would take books like this down and see, how did he do this? How do you stage a fight scene? Cause I had a friend doing comics when I was in college, and sometimes he would get scripts and it would be pages 14 to 17. And it would just say, they fight, go nuts. And he would,
Marvel method.
You got to give him a little something. So I would always try and work my fight scenes. But as I was leafing through this, what came to mind almost immediately is I drew a lot of comics as a kid. And I did small press comics in college and afterwards, mini comics before I started writing professionally. But even from junior high and through part of high school, I drew this series. I can't remember if I've told you guys before, but called Frog, where I was it was just this character. When I first started drawing him, he was bionic and he was kind of like a superhero, but he was also like a detective, but he also was like a space guy, just whatever story I wanted to tell. And I drew 62 issues of this thing. I did just mini comic sides, but they were about, 8 pages long. And, when I first started drawing them, they were really crude. And when I was done, they were still crude, but they were a lot better. And also whatever I was reading, you can tell when I discovered Burn X-Men. You could tell when I discovered Merrill Lynch Daredevil. In fact, I drew one issue where he went to New York for a comic book show and I drew Frank Miller in it. As a character in it, because I found a picture of Frank Miller. I'm like, oh, I'm going to draw Frank Miller in this. But there are so many fight scenes that I just ripped off of this. And I would start to draw, because originally I'd just draw 6 panels, standard grid. And here's where I started, I'll do thin panels, I'll do tall panels, I'll do all that. And it just really opened me up to the possibilities of a different way to tell a story. And a lot of this, Miller, I'd be the first to admit, especially in this era, was very influenced by Eisner. But like I said, I hadn't seen Eisner at this point. And he took Eisner in some different... Eisner never was that big an action guy. Like you would think, I mean, there were fight scenes in The Spirit, but it wasn't like this.
At the Eisner Studios, did he come out of that?
Did he?
I think he did.
Yeah.
I think...
the Eisner-Iger Studios.
I know.
I want to say that he did briefly, I think Simonson maybe sort of shut him a little bit
in his early days.
The thing that's really great about the fight scenes in this comic and Daredevil in general as he's doing it is the punches have impact, right? And it's he does the thing where that I don't think a lot of storytellers always do within comics, where it's actually this fight scene is going to be a series of moments of these two characters actually physically making contact with each other. Right. And so, like, this panel is Bullseye hitting her. This panel is Elektra hitting him. But instead of, like, sort of like, here's a montage of a bunch of scenes of a fight that are moments from the fight, he's sort of like,
yeah,
tells the fight.
You can see, right, like there's one point here. This is during their big fight when they're, like, essentially rolling on the ground, and she, like, goes to wrap her headscarf around his neck, and then he just, like, slams her head into the ground. And it's you're right. It's a fight. It feels like it would, this is not a superhero fight you would want to be in. It's not like, you know, big punches and people flying across the room. It looks,
yeah,
it hurts. It looks like it hurts.
There's a lot of times in comics, I feel like sometimes you see, like, a superhero fight or a fight. Well, you're not seeing the fight. You're seeing, like, a moment from the fight before we get to the next part where someone talks.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And, like, part of it, I think, is, like, I don't know if it's Frank being both the writer and the artist is like, well, like, actually this fight, we're going to see the fight from beginning to end. Like, you're not going to see glimpses of the fight. Like, you're going to see the whole, mm-hmm, yeah, lean into the lead.
Sorry.
Lee Van Cleef would agree, but you got to see, like, yeah, I feel like when you see these fights, you see it from beginning to end and you actually know what happens. Mm-hmm. And there's a story told within it, as opposed to, like, okay, here's, like you were saying, like, pages 14 through 17 is a fight.
Right, go.
You know,
right,
like, go crazy and show things, I mean, yeah, you know, right, and, like, and at the end, we'll have them talk to each, exactly, other, you know, like.
And it's, you're right, it's like, those fights are just, they're just, because the comic has to have a fight scene, so here's the fight scene, but this, in this, the fight scenes are the story. I mean, it's like, you know, like, a, yeah, good movie, like, the dance number will it won't just be a dance, it'll, mm-hmm, like, tell part of the story and it'll reveal character, and that's what happens here. And, you know, I'm looking through this, and I don't think when they're fighting, when Elektra is fighting Bullseye and when Daredevil's fighting Bullseye, there's no dialogue. I mean, they're not, like, not, yeah, just making quips, but they're not, yeah, there's none of that. It's like,
yeah,
but yeah, Bullseye, well, says, it's, ah, it's a, and then real, he says the one line Sal says, but the fight's essentially, yeah, over at that point.
Yeah, it was, I mean, these are incredibly highly trained killers who are in,
yeah,
a,
they're
fight
fighting
to
death, kill, that's, and, the thing, right, I mean, they're,
to have banter, to have, like, Spider-Man style banter in the middle of a fight where the other person can easily kill you, yeah, wouldn't,
and I love,
it, like, wouldn't make sense, right?
The Ditko Spider-Mans are some of my favorite comics ever, and I love those, yeah, fight scenes, but that's not this, and, you know, this shouldn't be, and no, you know, a lot of early, no, Daredevil, like in the Gene Colan stuff, he was bantering it up, you know. He was essentially Spider-Man in a, yeah, lot of ways, bouncing around and swinging, yeah, and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I looked,
yeah,
it up.
I mean, I was just going to say, in the fight with Daredevil at the end of the issue, there's no, I mean, they don't, as soon as that fight starts, all you hear the, or you see the inner monologue, mm-hmm, of Bullseye, but there's, they don't say anything,
the big, you
until,
won't save me.
Till he drops them. Yeah, there's 4 pages, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pages of fight and not a, mm-hmm, single.
And he Miller does that nice thing there's too when they go onto the train tracks and you just get that click, 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 you know, that's very, yeah, atmospheric, yeah, and, yeah,
it adds a tension,
yeah,
that, you know what I mean, like, you can hear it click, click, you know, and it's like it adds tension to that scene of like, oh shit, you know, like the train's coming, and you know it's a great
you guys are right, fight. I don't think until Daredevil says you'll kill no one ever again, I don't think Daredevil says anything in this issue. I don't think he says a single word, yeah, as Daredevil, and he barely says anything as Matt Murdock. He makes that big court speech, but, and maybe he says something in the morgue, but other than that, there's not much.
Yeah, it's just the little conversation that tips him off to that.
Right,
that,
yeah, he hears him, yeah.
Just, yeah, small talk, basically. I did a quick spot check. His first published work was at Gold Key Comics on the recommendation,
oh, okay,
of Neil,
well,
Adams,
that makes sense,
who he had shown his work to and got...
I also think it's funny that back in the 80s, if you wanted to sneak in and pretend to work at the morgue, you could just kill somebody and show up and say that he quit. And, like, I got hired.
Well, there is that funny line where he's like, yeah, he quit. He's like, he won't be back. He won't be. I mean, you know, again, it's like, you know, Sin City. I mean, I like some of it. It's kind of, I think you gave in some of Miller's worst writing impulses, but that's just good, terse, sharp, funny writing. I mean, it's,
yeah,
just, you know, there's one thing about this, because this is 82, like early, very early 82, like
81.
80, late 81.
Oh, yeah. December of 81.
Interesting time in comics because, you know, I personally think, and I think you guys would probably agree to, at least to an extent, that when Alan Moore came in, it really changed sort of how comics were written, an idea of how you could write a comic and how you could, you know, he really was a seismic change. Even in comics that weren't, even comics that didn't reflect how he wrote, they kind of were a reaction against it. Like, we're going to go more, you know, we don't need the, you know, highfalutin writing or this and that. But right before that, there were a lot of interesting comics. You know, you could feel comics almost looking for something like, we want to take the next step. Like, you had this, you had the X-Men to a certain extent, but you had, you know, some of the early independents. You had, like, you know, first, like, you had American Flag, and you had books like that right before, or maybe right, it was when Moore was on Swamp Thing and when Marvel Man was being published. And it just feels like comics were, they were all set to become something new, you know, and it did. I mean, it, you know, Watchmen and a lot of it was due to Miller. I mean, he had, in the space of about a year, you had Dark Knight, you had Year One, and you had Born Again, which are, you know, three all-timers. And you had Elektra Assassin. I mean, that's a,
yeah,
that's a hell of a run. And, you know, and he said, and it all was because of Daredevil, because nobody cared about Daredevil, so he could do weird stuff on it, and they didn't care.
Get away with it. Anyway,
have you ever read the Alan Moore essay about why he likes Frank Miller? I forget. It was in some Marvel UK thing. Mm-hmm. I got to dig it up somewhere. And some, it's like in one of those weird Marvel UK books where it's like, here's a Captain Britain story plus a Daredevil story, like... It was called Daredevils, and there's a whole section in one of the issues where Alan Moore talks about how much he loves Frank Miller in there. I'll dig it up and send it to you guys, a picture of it, because it's really interesting.
In one of those comics, there was also, and I can't remember who drew it, but Alan Moore did a spoof of Frank Miller's Daredevil. I should see if I could dig that up somewhere, because it's interesting. And it's this era Daredevil, and it's like pre-American Alan Moore. So it's all about like how gritty it is, and how, you know, I think it's called Grit, in fact, like the title of the story. But it's pretty good. It's pretty worth reading.
Awesome.
Well, going back to your point, though, a little bit, I was going to say, you know, the issue before this, Daredevil 180, is like this weird issue where Daredevil goes into the sewers
with the alligators
and fights some bizarre zombie king guy that's holding the kingpin's wife. It's like, what a weird contrast between that issue this issue.
That's of true. Like,
you know, well, it's almost like a filler or a throwback of an issue comparatively.
Well, what's part of it is, like, oh, I did read that issue zombies too, because I was like, what happens before this issue? I was just trying to set my brain. And one of the things I do, it's interesting, is because I feel it in 181 especially, is like Frank Miller's kind of like pushing against a lot of the, there's tension with superhero things, like secret, like your secret identity is stupid. Of course you'll be found out.
Right.
Like, of course, someone will figure, you're a lawyer, you're up talking, right? Like, and the way he presents that's just like part of the story is, of course someone's going to figure out what you're doing, you know, like, duh. Like, that's what's going to happen, you know? And, like, of course this guy is going to break out of jail. He can use anything as a weapon, you know? Like, he's still within the realm of comics, but is, like, pushing, like, sort of, like, this, like, Daredevil shouldn't have a secret. Of course someone will figure out Daredevil's secret identity. Yeah. Of course Bullseye will break out. Like, these conventions of how we think comics are, like, what a superhero story is, like, without being, like, this is stupid, because I don't think that's what it is. He is sort of like pushing against those things in the context of like Daredevil's the type of character who this would happen to, you know, like, and like really playing with those elements a lot, which I think makes it makes it resonate for years later, because you can recognize those things.
And I think, you know, when they did Born Again, where, you know, the whole impetus is Kingpin learns Daredevil's secret identity. And then it wasn't he, you know, Miller was smart enough to not just Kingpin didn't go on TV and say he's Daredevil. He didn't even try and kill Matt Murdock. He just slowly took apart his life. You know, that's I love those issues because I love a story where the hero is knocked down and down and down and down until finally he climbs back up. And it's just, you know, I mean, there's so many comics that are just kind of, you know, dark for the purpose of being dark and this and that. And I love a story that has like a, you know, when the hero gets to be heroic and, you know, and do something exciting, you can root for him. It's that's that one of my favorite Miller comics just because it's such an old fashioned comic in a way, but with modern plotting and modern twists. And, you know, he did a lot of Alan Moore kind of stuff in that, where how he treated the Avengers and Captain America as these frightening, otherworldly, powerful beings that Daredevil had virtually no relation. You know, they were something else. Like the first time Alan Moore wrote the Justice League in Swamp Thing, and it was like, they're scary. You know, they're you don't know them, and they are not like you. And, you know, now, I mean, now all comics are essentially written like that. But back then, it was exciting.
So, so Miller took over originally Daredevil 158 as the artist. He was a cover artist, and he was doing some issues of Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man. And then he started working with Roger McKenzie and Klaus Janson on Daredevil. And the art was great, but the stories were still kind of crappy, and it wasn't. And they were talking about canceling it, and then Denny O'Neill took over as
he was editor on this issue.
Editor, and
the great Denny O'Neill.
He found another job for McKenzie so that Miller could draw it and write it.
Yeah.
And
that's I think Miller's first became, you know, issue huge. As writer was Elektra's first issue.
168. Yeah. Yep. First full appearance.
You know, her name is spelled Elektra. Wrong on that cover, by the way. Have you ever noticed that? They put a C in it.
I did not.
On the cover, first appearance, and there's a big C.
Oh, comic.
It's like,
well, we didn't know. Baby.
Yeah, you know, nobody, you know, back then, it's like, who's going to care? These kids don't care. I don't know. Nobody, they don't collect them. Nobody's going to read this in 6 months. They won't be reprinted. There aren't trade paperbacks of these things.
Yeah. There's not going to be four grown men talking about this issue.
40-some years from now.
45 years.
Yeah, you think those little kids biting off the skins are going to care about it decades later? They'll have lives and families to deal with.
They're not going to have like giant hardcover editions of it. And
how are they going to connect? You know, there's not going to be a global web of some kind they can talk to.
Right.
Nice. All right, guys. Well, this was our first Under the Influence.
This was great. I'm so glad you gave me a reason to
read this.
I had a great time.
It's we knew that you were going to be our first.
I didn't realize I was picking such an obvious book, but I'm glad I picked this one because it's fun.
So you guys weren't in the text, but this was Will's second choice.
And I almost thought we were doing a different show tonight.
So Will of course picked American Flag number one.
My man.
But we are doing the American Flag, the first six issues as our trade talks, as picked by Sal. So to entice him to give us another comic to talk about, I told Will that he can sit in with us whenever we do the flag trade.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
So that'll be in probably a week or two, and we're already reaching out to other past guests on the show and just friends of ours to come in and do Under the Influence. So let us know how you liked it. You can just hit us up on all the socials or the emails and that kind of stuff. But it's something that I think we're looking forward to. It narrows the focus of what we're talking about and gives us a chance. I mean, we've never had a deep dive on Daredevil 181 before.
I was thinking today, if I had to do one, but not a book I've probably talked about in the past, and I was trying to dig up, I was like, what comic book do I really distinctly, like, I was trying to think of, like, I remember reading it. And one of the most memorable, I remember when I used to go to Fleet Farm with my dad. Not Farm and Fleet.
Fleet Farm, right?
Fleet Farm. Uh-huh. Different places.
Different color scheme.
Yep. Different color scheme. My dad, you know, who'd be looking at such things as like, I'm going to buy a length of chain, or I'm going to, you know, the type of things you do at Fleet Farm.
I have a shrub I need to pull out of the backyard with the tox.
Exactly. Yeah, it was going to be a lot of discussion.
And 17 gallons of kerosene. Yeah,
exactly. It was going to be a trip. So I could pick up something to read at the start, and I would sit in the cart and read it. And sometimes I would pick Mad Magazine. But one time there was a month or two where Marvel was putting out these like digest sized Spider-Man comics that I got really into when I was like, I must have been like seven. It was like right when I first read comics for the first time. And like, I remember reading, and like, I was young enough that I was so totally, I didn't know anything. I knew who Spider-Man was because it was a cartoon, but like, I didn't know these were old. You know, like, it's just like, it's Spider-Man, you know, so you're reading them. So I read, like, I remember reading the one where Gwen Stacy's dad dies and being like, oh my God, I can't believe that he knew that Peter Parker was Spider-Man. And I remember being in the cart at Fleet Farm reading this like very poorly printed, like digest sized one and being like, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. As my dad's, you know, looking at like, you know, wood paneling, trying to find like the right size of it.
Excellent. Well, maybe the first comic I ever remember reading is my mom bought it for me when I was like, I don't know, five or six, whatever year it was, like for a trip to grandma's house. And it was the Spider-Man, I want to say 122. It's where Green Goblin dies after Gwen. It's like the issue after Gwen Stacy dies and Green Goblin dies. And it is so depressing for a child. It's like Green Goblin dies, Gwen Stacy dies. Everybody hates Spider-Man. I mean, they hate him. Harry Osborn is on PCP, like, and he won't talk to Peter. It's like so bad.
Negative.
It is. And as a little kid, I'm like, this isn't what the cartoon is like.
What is this?
Yeah, who wrote
Where's
that?
Where's Iceman?
Conway? That one, yeah. Jerry Conway did the death of the Stacys and all that. You know, why he killed Gwen Stacy.
What?
He hated the character because it was based on Stan Lee's wife.
Really?
That's a rumor.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I guess Jerry's the only one left of that group to tell that story. So.
Yeah. I saw him at a Comic-Con here in Milwaukee a couple years back. So, Will,
how could he hate Joan?
Joan Lee.
Right. Joan Lee. Come on.
The other thing is that because it's not the most influential comic to you, we'll let people know that this doesn't mean that we can't have people back as return guests to talk about other comics that have influenced.
Obviously,
them.
I would love to be.
This
back.
Won't be yes. the last
but,
time.
You know, yeah. I understand it. Not immediately.
Yeah.
Why was I not invited back immediately?
Right. Why are we recording another episode right now?
So I think that, you know, are we good? We still want to keep these around an hour or so. Is that all set? We obviously have to ask you what you're up to. You know, thank you for coming and being our first guest on this, but what do you have
I'm
going
still
on?
Writing the Nine for Interpop Comics. It's an online comic. It's a big crazy superhero action, and you can read it for free if you go to Interpop. All one word, comics.com. And there's like a section like read for free, and you can read some past issues. And it's like, it's fun though. It's superheroes you've never heard of, but it's big, crazy cosmic. It's very unlike this issue of Daredevil.
Not gritty. Not gritty and women getting stabbed through their spine. Oh, forget it then.
Then of course, you're one of the constants on Film Force 5. part of the larger AC family. And and we can't forget that. Are you still doing the part time DJ gig with the Moondog?
I'm doing a weekly radio show. It's an hour long. It airs on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Central Time, and then it replays on the weekends. If you go to my Facebook page or Twitter, you can find out when it's airing, and that's on suburbsradio.com. It's so much fun. It's just digging in my record collection. The upcoming episode for next week will be all movie songs, but different movie songs, at least two from Russ Meyer movies. So there we go.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
I was just watching, what was I watching? Super Vixens?
So good.
Too long ago. That's
the thing about his movies are so crazy, but they're perfectly edited and perfectly shot. I mean, the guy knew what he was doing. He was just telling insane stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Good stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks, Will. So we appreciate it. And an awesome issue, of course. And I don't have anything else. I think we covered it pretty damn well.
I'm glad we didn't come in with, like, you know, eight ball number four.
tempting.
I am very interested at some point. Like, I want to get to the point where it's like somebody picks something that I've never read,
right?
And you know what I mean, like, in something that maybe, or maybe something that I didn't,
that would,
like,
be interesting, I think.
Or you know what I mean, somebody. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
All right. But, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Will. We'll see you. We got
Film
more
Force 5 coming
Film
up.
Force 5 episodes coming up. And then you'll be back to help us navigate the trade talk on American Flag, the first six issues. We're going to work on more guests for this. We'll hopefully get to the point that we give you like a week's heads up, so you can read the comic at home before we talk about it. I think would be fun. So we're working towards that. In between time, we'll be everywhere in
heading around comics. We didn't do drink roll call. What the hell?
It's next time. Yeah, I'm drinking tea.
I'm drinking canned water.
Boring.
Yeah.
I had a sidecar.
Oh, very nice. I had a tequila squirt, or a hillbilly margarita. Is there no?
There you go.
Oh, I love a bourbon and squirt.
I do love a bourbon.
I love a bourbon and squirt.
Chris introduced me to the beauty of the bourbon squirt.
Yep.
Tequila and squirt is an excellent, interesting mix.
I've got some mezcal and some squirt. I may do that.
I'm telling you, the tequila and squirt is an interesting combination. Yeah. It's a different thing.
We want to talk cocktails, boys. All right, let's bring that.
We can do that.
We can turn this off and just talk cocktails afterwards.
Yeah. Well, let's do it. Yeah. We'll have a true drink roll call next week.
Next time. All right. Bye bye.